The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. Does this sound okay? Okay. Very nice to be back here at IMC. I started sitting here, or when this group was in Palo Alto, about 12 or 13 years ago. And I remember the Sunday mornings used to be in Portola Valley, if anyone remembers that. I'm kind of amazed at how many people are here and how much the group has grown. And I can really feel the strength of your practice here. It's nice to be back. So this practice, in a way, way I think about it, is there's a certain beautiful simplicity to it, just to be here, to open to our experience, the experience of this moment, without trying to change it in any way. In a way, what could be simpler than that? And yet, most of us, when we sit down to do the practice, we find it somewhat or mildly or extremely difficult to just be here. It's so easy to get seduced by our minds and pulled off in various directions. My Zen teacher used to say, the most difficult place to be is here. And the most difficult thing to do is this. So what makes it difficult? This is a big topic, and there are forces in the mind, which you probably noticed, which sort of tug us or pull us or sometimes yank us away from what's happening now. And a basic principle of this practice is, if we want to be present, if we want to be calm, if we want to be concentrated, at some point we need to look at and understand the forces that prevent us from being present, that kind of interrupt our mindfulness. So these difficulties, these distractions that we struggle with, is what I would like to explore this morning. Until I began this practice, I had no idea how much my mind moved around. Kind of like a pinball machine or like a little puppy that's moving every which way. Completely uncontrollable. It's like, pulled by my thinking, my moods, my desires, my dislikes, my habits. And then coming here, and something about attempting to be still, to be present, it offers a reference point. One image I think of is, a mountain stream that's very shallow, and it looks still. It almost looks completely still. It looks like the water isn't moving. But when we put a stick in the water, all of a sudden you can see the currents moving around the stick. With a reference point that's actually still, we can see movement. And I think the same is true for what we're doing here. when we're outside, when we're in the world, as we move around, it's a little bit difficult to tell what our mind is like. But when we sit here, we have a reference point. You know, and the reference point is our intention to be here, to be present, to be mindful. And what we notice is all of the movements of mind, all the distractions, all the things that pull us away, make it difficult to be here. So the strongest of these distractions, these forces in the mind, have a special name in the Buddhist teaching, and they're called the hindrances. And they're called the hindrances because they are what hinders or obstructs our ability to be present. And I would suggest that if we want to be more present, if we want to be more concentrated, more calm, more mindful, these hindrances are extremely useful to get to know. It's like to get really close to them, to know them inside and out, to be so familiar with them and how they operate in us. This is precisely what deepens the meditation. It deepens the meditation in the direction of freedom. So the Buddha identified the five most common hindrances that can obstruct our meditation. You might have heard them before. They are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and then doubt. The five groupings, and sloth and torpor are grouped together, and restlessness and worry are grouped together. One easy way of remembering them is that the first four are sort of opposites. You know, desire and ill will is like, I want it and I don't want it. Sloth and torpor is too little energy, and restlessness, worry, is too much energy, and then doubt. So to say a few words about these in general, in and of themselves, these qualities of mind, these forces of mind, are not a problem. The problem in the meditation, and sometimes in our life, comes in when we don't see them. When we don't notice that a hindrance is present, it can control us. It can pull us away, distort our perception, blocks our ability to see clearly. So these forces, these hindrances, are said to operate in everyone. They're universal. And a part of our humanity, part of our humanness. So I think it's very helpful to see them this way and not to take their presence as a kind of a personal failing, or something, that's so unique. These hindrances, how they function is they color and they distort our perception. So much to the point that it's recommended that we not make decisions, if possible, under the influence of a hindrance. Just looking at the newspaper, you can see examples of why it's a bad idea to make decisions when a hindrance is present. careers can be ruined, reputations, relationships, all just because of a hindrance, you know, that was not seen. You know, maybe some craving for a sense pleasure that wasn't seen in the mind. So these hindrances are visitors to the mind. They come and they go. Sometimes they're present and sometimes they're absent. And I can only speak for myself, but I think we can be so used to their presence in our mind and in our daily life, you know, we may not notice them, or, you know, we may think that they're a permanent part of our mind. Early in my practice, I wasn't so, you know, I'm sure I had heard this teaching, and I wasn't so interested in it. And I would just, you know, for a one-day sitting or a retreat or something, I would sit down to meditate. And the entire day, I would just be lost in, you know, I'm a desire type, so some kind of fantasy, a reverie, completely lost. And as I look back, I can see how clearly, you know, a hindrance was operating. So a strong hindrance can be very useful data about ourselves. You know, it's sort of an opportunity to learn about ourselves, what makes us tick. You know, it's like, oh, this is interesting. This memory brings up, you know, anger or strong aversion. You know, it's like a recurring hindrance, maybe trying to tell us something. And if we're too quick to suppress a hindrance or try to get rid of it without letting the message sort of register, it will probably come back. You know, so a hindrance can be very mild, so subtle that it's barely noticeable. You know, so if in the meditation, when the mind is getting very still, there may be just a little bit of excitement. It's like, oh, you know, this is good. Or, you know, a little bit of restlessness. At the other end of the spectrum, a hindrance can be so overpowering and so incredibly strong, you know, like an addiction, for example. And I think the more practiced we are at noticing the hindrance in the meditation, the more language and the more capacity we have for noticing them and how they operate in our life. So rather than ignoring them or indulging them, we aim to understand them. And the way to do that in the Vipassana practice is to turn towards the hindrance itself and include it in the meditation. It's like there's something about this shift, this pivot, is very, very important in this practice. When we do this, and we include it in the meditation, the hindrance itself transforms from being something that obstructs the meditation to becoming an object of the meditation itself. The difficulties which seem like obstacles to the practice actually become the practice. In the suttas, the effect of the hindrances is explained through the image of a bowl of water or a pond. It's like, if you think about it, when a pond is perfectly still, it reflects an image accurately. You know, it works perfectly as a mirror. So when sensual desire is present, it's said that it's like looking at the water mixed with dye, you know, mixed with a coloring. Something about our perception is colored. When ill will or aversion is present, the effect is like water that's boiling. You know, it's bubbling up. And this prevents the kind of reflection. The effect of sloth and torpor is said to be like water that's overgrown with algae. We can't see through. We can't get a good reflection. Restlessness and worry is as if wind has whipped up the water. We can't see. And doubt is as if the water is muddy. So just as each of these prevent the water from reflecting, they have an effect on our minds and prevent us from seeing clearly. So sensual desire, this is a big one. This can be a very powerful obstacle to staying present. Usually in these lists of Buddhist obstacles, sense desire is the first one. So it is clinging in a compulsive way to sense pleasure, you know, a kind of a craving for sense pleasure. Just to be clear, it's like desire itself is not a problem. You know, desire can be healthy or unhealthy. But when desires become compulsive, you know, as craving, clinging, to the point of addictions, these are what hinder our ability to see clearly, and they serve to disconnect us from our actual experience. You know, in meditation, sensual desire often takes the form of fantasy, you know, around things we want, you know, food, comfort, sex. It's like the fantasies themselves can feel so pleasant that at first we don't really notice them as, you know, and we don't see that at first. You know, we get caught up in the content. And whether we're meditating or not, a sensual desire can seduce us. It has a very convincing quality, and, you know, often I find myself acting on it before I've even, you know, way before I've noticed that it's present. One example, just the other night, I like to meditate at night, and I finished a sitting. And I kind of remembered that we had cookies, fresh baked cookies downstairs. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'm not that hungry, and I just brushed my teeth, but maybe I just go down and take a look at them. And so, yeah, they're still there. And the next, like, 5 minutes, I must have blacked out or something. Because I, you know, one after the other. Get some milk, open the computer, you know, it's like, and then it's like, what am I doing here? Sensual desire is like that, you know. We get caught, and, you know, or another example is sometimes maybe you can relate to this, I like to meditate, and I use my cell phone as a timer. But if I forget to put it on silent mode, you know, sit down and everything's good, and close my eyes, you know, rising, falling, rising, and then ding! It's like a text message or email. And it's like that compulsion to check it. I was meditating. Sensual desire can be such a big hindrance to meditation because it's connected to something so basic, which is the pleasant or unpleasant feeling tone of our experience. You know, it's like we're hardwired. We want what's pleasant, and we don't want what's unpleasant. And sensual desire can operate on both sides. It's like if there's a pleasant smell, for example, you know, freshly brewed coffee, or favorite food, it's like, I want. And it's so instinctual. The connection is straightforward. I like it, I want it. But when there's something unpleasant, like let's say, you know, something uncomfortable, a pain in the knee while we're meditating, we can escape from that unpleasant sensation by replacing it with, you know, pleasant fantasy, pleasant memory. The same with an unpleasant emotion, like loneliness or sadness. You know, off we go into a kind of comfort food or mental comfort food. So how to work with desire, with sensual desire. Sometimes it's enough to just notice it, and just bring mindfulness to it. When this doesn't work, there are various other strategies that can be helpful. I think it can be helpful to try to see the object of the desire more clearly. You know, often sensual desire involves an unrealistic projection onto the object. It can also be very helpful to feel, to come back into the body and to feel like what it feels like to be desiring. It's actually not very pleasant, you know, to be in the grip of a compulsive desire. And, you know, we just had Thanksgiving. I don't know about you, but I definitely, when I pushed away from the table and I noticed, you know, I was like, oh, this doesn't feel good. I ate so much. And it was pleasant while I was eating, but if I had looked more closely, you know, it doesn't feel good. So the second hindrance is considered the opposite to sensual desire, and that is ill will, sometimes called aversion. You know, and this includes the whole range from minor irritation or annoyance to, you know, hatred, basically a kind of violent hatred. What really helped me to understand ill will is remembering that all ill will comes from the basic human impulse to get away from something that is unpleasant, something that's painful. So ill will constricts our body and mind. We tighten around it, and we become more reactive. Like compulsive desire, ill will or aversion, it separates us, you know, and it can kind of alienate us and disconnect us from our experience. I know in my life I've said things, you know, out of anger, you know, out of the heat of anger, that later I really regretted. You know, in one moment, a relationship, a friendship can be damaged forever when we don't see that ill will, we don't see the aversion. anger, for example, can often be a strategy that covers a more primary emotion, like feeling hurt or fear. And sometimes it's easier to feel anger than to actually drop down and feel the fear or the vulnerability, the hurt that's underneath the anger. So how to work with ill will. You know, when we can, to see it and to note it as aversion, and to feel the root unpleasantness can be very helpful. It's also helpful to look at what may be being covered over by the anger or the ill will. And traditionally, qualities like patience, gratitude, loving kindness, these can all counter and, you know, be a kind of antidote to neutralize the ill will. Sloth and torpor, kind of old-fashioned words, I think about these as kind of a physical or mental laziness, you know, or a dullness, lethargy. I don't know if you can relate to this example, but, you know, there have been times when I'm meditating at night and I just feel so tired, you know, it's like I'm just exhausted, like, oh, I should probably go to bed, you know, just be good to myself. And then finish the meditation and I look over and what do I see? I see my iPad. You know, and I pick it up and I turn it on and it's sort of amazing. You know, I get this second wind. Just read the news, check my email. You know, where did the tiredness go? You know, and so this is an example of this hindrance of sloth and torpor. It's not that we don't have energy, but it's that for some reason we're cut off from the energy. It's often, this hindrance is often present when there is a resistance, a kind of a resistance to dealing with something. I know when I look at the pile of unopened mail, unopened bills, on the dining room table, it's like, I'm so tired. I can't even do it. So the traditional ways of working with this hindrance are to arouse energy in the body and arouse energy in the mind. In the body, it's said it can be very helpful to if you're sitting, to stand up, to do walking meditation or to do faster walking. You can open your eyes when you're sitting. Something to wake the body up. To arouse the mind, it's said to be helpful to reflect on, traditionally, said to reflect on death. You know, something about how fleeting and how precious this time is that we have. And sometimes that can kind of give us a jolt. I know sometimes for me, it's enough to just look at the newspaper and some story and something will just, you know, really register. And I feel like, oh yeah, you know, life is fleeting. A friend of mine, I just visited him in the hospital. He's a 30-year-old guy, and he very suddenly came down with a case of meningitis, of spinal meningitis, which is extremely serious, 10 to 15% fatality great. You know, and this is someone who I just had breakfast with last week, and so something about this, remembering this, it can serve to dispel this hindrance. So restlessness and worry is sort of an opposite to sloth and torpor. It's like too much energy, you know, maybe a little bit jittery, anxious, unsettled, agitated, hyperactive. It can be physical or mental, and it can take many forms. Often this hindrance has a root in fear. To counter this agitation, we can make a special emphasis to cultivate stillness. Just something about calming the body, tuning into the breathing, mindfulness of breathing. What's also said to be very helpful is to develop, kind of cultivate trust in the Dharma. You know, sometimes restlessness can be so strong that, you know, it almost feels like a rodeo. And in this case, it can be enough to just sit, you know, just to not get up and finish the period can be a very meaningful victory over restlessness. So the final hindrance is doubt. And usually, you know, so this can be doubt about the practice, doubt about the teacher, or doubt about oneself. And doubt can be very convincing. It can be very difficult to see doubt as doubt. And it's said that doubt, when doubt is present very strongly, it's like there's some kind of lack of trust. You know, it may come up, you know, even listening to this talk, you know, it may come up, you know, why am I here? Sunday morning, where's Gil? Is it there? You know, he's probably at Starbucks. I should... even when the meditation is very refined and the mind is very still, there can be this little voice. You know, I know I've experienced this. Of it's like, you know, it's like, you can't do this, or something. This is not real, or, you know, something. It's doubt. And to overcome doubt, we have to see it clearly. You know, noting it as doubt can create a certain kind of distance. And what counters doubt is developing this faith, trust, confidence, trusting in the Dharma and trusting in ourselves. So these are the five hindrances. The word in Pali for hindrance is nivarana, which etymologically it means a covering. You know, so these are the five coverings, and I think an interesting question is, what do they cover over? You know, I would like to suggest that they cover over precisely what we want to avoid, what we don't want to experience. You know, it's like if the most difficult place to be is here, then these hindrances are sort of strategies, you know, unconscious strategies usually, for dealing with some aspect of here that we want to get away from, you know, that we don't want to experience. You know, it's like, I am not here to feel that. And so it's fundamentally this process of avoidance. You know, in this moment, we're unwilling or unable to keep feeling what we're feeling. So away we go. You know, take a break from my knee pain through a kind of delicious fantasy. Another good one is covering over feelings of frustration with anger. You know, it's like there have been times I've been on a retreat and I've gotten so upset. The person next to me breathing so loudly. Why are they breathing like that? Don't they know? You know, we're all sitting here. And, you know, you get angry. And it's easier to feel angry than to drop into that frustration or that vulnerability. I think often repetitive thoughts or repetitive worries have a payoff as well. And in a way, they can cover over deeper fears or deeper vulnerabilities. You know, so this practice always comes back to a kind of non-avoidance, you know, willingness to be here, to be who we are in this moment. I think of this quote by Carl Jung. When an inner situation is not made conscious, it appears as from the outside as fate. You know, so in a way, what we're doing is we're shining the light of awareness on these hindrances. You know, we bring them into consciousness. I think it's a little bit difficult to describe what it feels like to be totally free of the hindrances. One example I've used before is swimming. You know, I like to swim laps. I haven't done it in a while, but when I would go to my local pool. One time, there were these paddles, these hand paddles, and they're kind of neoprene or, you know, rubber paddles. And I thought, oh, you know, those are interesting. And I put them over my hands, and I started to swim. And I, you know, started to do laps, you know, 15 or 20 minutes. And I thought, okay, you know, this is interesting. Feels slightly different than usual, but I didn't really notice so much. I felt a little more tired than usual. I couldn't really notice such a big difference. Then I took them off, and I swam, and it was amazing. It felt so different. There was no drag, no resistance at all. Just completely gliding through the water, cutting through the water. I felt so light, so free, no struggle at all. You know, sort of harmonizing or merging with the water. It's like when the hindrances, when these five hindrances are completely absent, it's a little bit like that. It's like, you know, there's no wind drag. When the hindrances are absent, there's no barrier to concentration, to deeper concentration, and to the factors that lead to awakening. So, classically, freedom from the hindrances is described like this. To be free from sense desire is like being freed from a debt. To be free from aversion is like recovering from a physical illness. to be free from sloth and torpor. It's like being released from prison. Being free from restlessness and worry is like being liberated from slavery. And to overcome doubt is like crossing a dangerous land safely. When we face what's difficult, the difficulties themselves become the path. And we accomplish this through one factor, which is sati, mindfulness. We turn towards the hindrances with mindfulness. Even though mindfulness is the key that unlocks this, I think of there's another important lubricant, which sort of oils the lock, and it can be so helpful. And this is the quality of kindness, you know, of friendliness, of metta, of compassion. It's like, as I said before, I think of these hindrances as strategies. You know, they're kind of our way of coping. And in their misguided way, they're trying to help us. So something like, can we meet them without clinging, without aversion? Can we cultivate compassion, have a compassionate relationship to our own struggles? This is Rumi. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Sometimes the best thing we can do, the only thing we can do in the face of these forces that oppose stillness is to simply, very simply, just be still. You know, to sit still in the midst of the hurricane. You know, it's like, let the hurricane of emotions come and wash over us. And we just stay still. We become the still observer of our experience. I like to end with one more quote. Suzuki Roshi was an influential and beloved Zen teacher who founded the San Francisco Zen Center. I've practiced there, and some of you have, I think. In the middle of a week-long intensive retreat, he gave a Dharma talk, which consisted of only 7 words. And I like to think that the topic of this talk was the hindrances. It's simple, but I think very profound. So he said, you know, and all the students and all the monks, you know, sitting with aching legs, and he said, "Please don't be bothered by your mind." Isn't that great? It took me an hour to say that. So please don't be hindered by your hindrances. Thank you.